It's also pretty awkward. And how's that? Are you just looking at the levels, are you?
Yeah, I'm looking at the... You're the top one as you speak.
Hey, I can't... Oh, yeah, there. Yeah, that's fine.
Good. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Wombat Radio. Today, we're on the SCA campus, Sydney College of the Arts. Don't know if we'll be back. We're talking to Dean Cross. Dean, would you care to introduce yourself, please?
Hello, Internet. My name is Dean Cross. I am a visual artist, retired contemporary dancer.
And what are you thinking about?
Many things. Currently involved in the debacle that is the Sydney University merger of its visual arts school, Sydney College of the Arts. And I am in the middle of negotiations as a student representative for the undergraduate student body about and trying to, see what I can do to help the undergraduate students of the future.
Mm. The ones who don't even know yet that they're coming here.
That's right. That's right. It's the students. They're probably in year 10. They're in year 9. They're even earlier.
They might not have even moved to Australia.
They may not have even moved to Australia. That's true. They don't even know you that they want to move. Maybe they do know they want to be artists. Some people do. But no, those are the people that I'm trying to secure a degree worth doing, basically. The proposal at the moment is a pretty watered down, light visual arts degree, and we are doing what we can to beef that back up and have it as close as possible to what's currently offered here in Roselle.
Yeah, I'd never thought about the watering down of degrees, but I guess I feel that way about some dance. Degrees, how what they have become from what they could have been or what they once were.
Yeah, and one of the issues that we're facing is a short-sighted view on contemporary art practice, and this is something that I brought up in a meeting a week or two ago with the provost, and the provost is the money man for all non-university people. The man who controls the money, and he is the man who's authoring the what's called the DCP, the draft change proposal. And I brought up to him that the current plan, the idea of what the art school will look like in the future, only reflects the current market value of contemporary art. It reflects a painting strong practice. Because currently paintings are what sell, abstract paintings especially. It's easy to sell, user-friendly, anybody can have one. Great. But as everybody knows, the art market is fickle. It changes rapidly, and something that might be valuable or in vogue at the moment may not necessarily be in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, 20 years' time. And if they eliminate certain mediums, for example, glass, which is on the chopping block, they are denying future artists the opportunity to engage in a practice that they might not yet know that they want to engage with. I mean, a few of our glass artists here had never thought about glass, had never been interested in glass, but tried it out for a little while, and now they make beautiful glass sculptures and glass-related work.
Which are valuable, but which don't sell for high amounts of money, like an abstract painting.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, exactly. So it's sort of, they have a value, and obviously, I mean, they're a useless object, but as all art is, useless objects. I mean, and they obviously have a material value. I mean, glass is a really tough one because I think it's very difficult for glass work specifically to transcend its materiality to be anything other than glass, and our kind of cultural and social knowing of glass is so fixed that it's difficult for a glass work to not look like a functional object. Yeah. Gone wrong maybe, or to not look like a vase, or and the materiality of the form and the way that it's made also pushes the material into those forms on its own, you know. So it's you know, I mean, I guess nearly anything can be done, but the glass itself wants to become bubbles, it wants to become cups, it wants to become that sort of thing. And, you know, we've got enough of those.
Yeah. There's an essay blog called Ribbon Farm by Venkatesh Rao, and one of his essays I read last week was about lean thinking versus fat thinking within organizational structures.
Right.
And that we're in a lean mode at the moment where it is efficiency that is prized and championed over efficacy, actually, even over being effective, but more so that it's so quantifiable that it's very seductive to push towards efficiency, but that can only cause iteration, which may sometimes be taken as innovation, but it can never cause invention, because invention comes from fat phases where there is excess in the machine, and that means that people are not trying to innovate their way out of a problem. They are following curiosity for no market purpose until they find the thing that we never thought that we needed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's hugely relevant to what's going on here. I mean, and even broader in the art school, if it's only offering just enough, then there isn't that room. I think excess is a great word, you know, and maybe bringing it back to dance, when you kind of, you know, you might improvise for a day, and by the end of the day, do you start to feel like maybe you're getting somewhere, because you get rid of all the kind of accumulated stuff that's other people's dances inside you, or whatever it might be, baggage, until you can get to something that sort of you might feel like is yours, or whatever you might be looking for. And I guess it's perhaps similar here, yeah, where if you kind of, I mean, it's one of the issues anyway with institutional art. Anyway, you know, you've got always, you're on a time, a 12 to 15 week schedule. It doesn't matter what you're making, unless you're in the postgraduate sort of bracket, but as undergraduate students. So there's already this sort of construct imposed on you and your project management, and you're not really given the opportunity as a real artist. I'm doing inverted fingers, commas, rabbit ears for all those of you who are listening. You can't see me. For real, I'll do it again, real artists who have the luxury, if they have the luxury, if they have a patron or no mortgage or whatever the case may be, to have that. That's sort of one of the other things that's being sort of stripped away.
So excess is essential. It's almost like what we're saying.
I mean, I guess that is what we're saying in a way. At least in this context, it is, you know, you need to be able to make mistakes. You know, I think kind of every artist knows that. It's okay to fail. It's okay to make mistakes because, I mean, depending on the day, perhaps you've never actually really made one anyway. Might not be exactly what you're looking for, but it's always going to be something at least. And then the real skill is perhaps then figuring out what's worth keeping and what's not.
Yeah, well, it's like that anecdote about science, that real discoveries are made not when someone says, aha, I did exactly what I thought. It's when someone says, oh, that's strange.
Yeah, I agree.
And that's another way of saying a mistake.
Yeah, for sure.
If we switch to your own way of being an artist? Because I don't really like.
Is that a question?
The question is that at some point you'll no longer be a student here.
Yeah. In a few weeks.
Yeah. At some point.
Yeah.
And then that means that you're not existing in the 15-week time bracket.
That's right.
What do you then begin existing within?
Just, I don't know, outside the bubble, I guess. Would it, you know, back into the real world, maybe? I don't know. I mean, that's a tough question, but I don't want to fall too deep down the existence rabbit hole. But, no, I mean, I think that my next step anyway is to do an honours year, and then depending on how the honours goes, is to pursue further into academia and do a PhD. But, I mean, that's sort of the plan. things never really go to plan.
Yeah, and sometimes for the best.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I guess also it's like, what will your thinking be wrapping itself around on the artist side of you rather than the...
Towards, I mean, I can tell you a bit about what I'm going to be working on for my grad show. I mean, I've just kind of got a whole bunch of work out of myself. I just had that show open on Friday in Brisbane. So it was good to kind of have that like out of my brain. I can let that all go now. I'm going to be working on sort of, I mean, I've learned over the past few years that really what interests me most in the work that I do is to kind of smash together narratives that don't necessarily belong with each other. Mm. One narrative generally being the kind of accepted, taught, hegemonic narrative, and then the other usually the kind of othered narrative, the suppressed narrative, or the story that's there but not necessarily has been kind of had the opportunity to be written into the history books. I think that we're sort of, well, I'm sort of starting to think more of like, you know, history as not so linear, but as this sort of web-like kind of constellation where things are connected in numerous different ways, in a kind of more of a three-dimensional way, mm. you know, than a two-dimensional straight line. And so I'm going to try and sort of connect. I mean, I'm really interested. I've always been a big fan of Ned Kelly and his narrative and his kind of the ambiguity maybe around whether or not he's a good guy or a bad guy.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if we've made up our mind, and I like that to some he's one and to others he's other. And, you know, he's an icon, there's no doubt about that, but is he a good one or a bad one? We're not quite sure. I mean, he was existing outside the law, but he was existing outside the law for the right reasons. So I like that about his narrative. But then I remember or think about the kind of other people whom have been kind of outlaws or whatever, particularly, I guess, like the indigenous kind of frontier wars and all these kind of heroes that are demonized because they're indigenous. You know, they're not really written into the history books, or they haven't been up until now written into the history books as heroes, but kind of as villains, you know, as the bad guys getting in the way of colonization and kind of, you know, I mean, you hear about massacres, and I remember being a kid and you're always sort of taught, oh, you know, sometimes massacres happened, but it was always because there was, you know, but because they killed a cow, you know, because they killed a sheep, or, you know, and that kind of, you know, I just think we know better. We know better these days, you know, and I think it's time to kind of, you know, do what we can to be better represent history, Australian history, in a more accurate kind of way, and not just sort of celebrating, I don't know, celebrating some things and demonizing others for convenience.
Mm.
I mean, I was just at a Vietnam vets memorial on Thursday, and you know, they were sort of talking about how great the Aussies were and what a great job they did at Long Tan, and, you know, really proud of themselves that they killed 500 Vietnamese peasants, were blowing them up and doing all sorts of terrible things. And I just feel like, you know, surely we're a bit more enlightened now where we can still talk about these things, but then also sort of say, you know, but maybe killing all these Vietnamese people wasn't such a great thing, you know. I mean, we were fighting what we thought was a bad idea, and maybe the world might be better off because of it. But I just feel like the kind of generic us versus them, bad guys, good guys, no longer stands.
Yeah. You
know, it's not that simple, and it can never be that simple. It was never that simple, and it will never be that simple. Any conflict that is still being fought.
Yeah. Anyway. It's almost like it could be as straightforward as when there's a moment of silence to remember the fallen.
Yeah.
It's all the fallen.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, that's exactly what I try and think about, you know, in those, we did have a minute silence, and that is what I was trying to think about. Everybody that's fallen. I mean, I read somewhere, you know, probably on the internet, so who knows how reliable it is, but in the 20th century, 260 million people died just in conflict, like directly from conflict. It's a huge amount of people.
That's the population of the USA.
Bit less, yeah.
Yeah.
I think they're like 300.
And that's 10 times the population of Australia.
And so, like, when you think about that, and like only in 100 years and only just in war, like, let alone everybody else that died, but, you know. Yeah, anyway. So that's sort of kind of where I'm at, and trying to kind of connect, yeah, that Ned Kelly story and just these kind of disparate historical narratives, and kind of find a space for them to coexist, so that you might then rethink the narratives that have kind of given themselves pole position, you know, or like the number one position, and whether or not that is kind of relevant.
Yeah, anymore. It seems like the narrative, whether it is ambivalent or not, can cause harm in its own perpetuation.
Yeah. Yeah, I just don't think it needs to. I think it's like totally acceptable to kind of have more questions. You know, I think a lot of the time that like we solidify historical narratives because we can't really handle not knowing, you know, but I think it's okay to kind of go, well, I don't really know who the bad guys were. Maybe it's not as simple as good versus evil, because obviously it's perspective, you know, and if you're on one side of the team, you're going to have a different perspective to the conflict to the other people that's on the other side. And that, you know, I think if we worked a little bit harder at kind of accepting that and embodying that, then it might be easier to solve the conflicts, you know.
I also feel very lucky that I have lived through a time of peace on my own home soil.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm not sure if I agree with that, but
yeah, which is why I say it. I mean, it's part of my job in this discussion is to say things that like make you say, well, hang on. But what I mean is, in the traditional idea of conscription to go and fight an ideology,
yeah,
I've never had my own survival tested.
No, that's true.
And I have to acknowledge that when I consider that I am at odds with these old ways of knowing our own history, but I can never condemn the people of that time in the way that I am a product of my time and they are a product of their time. And so I want to know your thoughts about how to not just condemn, how to not condemn people who are responsive to their circumstance. Maybe sometimes they are not.
I mean,
but I guess
think that's like one of the, for me, that's a real issue because it's like you hear it so much with the Stolen Generation, right? But it wasn't me. Why should we be sorry? I had nothing to do with it.
I think I'm asking more that, like, how can I say, yes, it was me. Yes, I am descended from those people.
Yeah.
What they did was wrong.
Mm.
But I'm not going to disown them because they are my granddad. They are.
Yeah, that's. I mean, and I think that should be the way to go forward. I mean, I look at like Germany as the kind of the perfect example of that, where, you know, we all know the atrocities that happened in Germany, and instead of trying to pretend like that nothing happened, like we do here. They talk about it, they own it, you know. There's that new Michael Moore documentary, have you seen it? Anyway, it's great. And there's that part where he's in Germany and the students, there's this refugee, he's saying, you know, I was born in wherever he was born, I'm now naturalized, I'm a German citizen, so it's my responsibility to undo what was done by the Germans past, you know. And I feel like that's sort of, you would never get an Australian to say that, you know, or a refugee, because our culture doesn't allow it. We still don't want to even accept our own misgivings in our own past. You know, and they're comparable. I mean, if not kind of worse. You know, I think that certainly Indigenous people have lost more than the Jewish people. You know, I think that it may not have happened in such a short period of time or perhaps so violently, but I mean, that's arguable too, but, you know, I think the cultural loss has been far greater for sure and still continues, you know. I mean, it's really like they blow my mind. Like Israel blows my mind, and like what's going on, and how they now are kind of neo-colonizing Palestine and just moving in, just straight up moving in, buying houses, and here we are, we live here now. See you guys. This is now like we live here, and displacing Palestinian people. And but because of the kind of everything else that's going on in the world, the media machine wants us to hate the Palestinians because they're Arabic, they speak Arabic, they're probably Muslims, even though most of them are Christian. They're probably terrorists, you know. But the true terrorists in that conflict are the Israelis. There's no doubt about it. They have more power, they have more money, they're more determined to displace people whom have just as much claim. I mean, the Israel's claim is God gave it to us. Come on.
Which is kind of a... Britain's claim on every colony it stepped onto, that they're the God-given race. And
yeah, that's true, but you know, most of them, our own accepted, have kind of, you know, unwritten that part of the history, gone, well, yeah, you know, we know that's not the case and we're going to still be part of the Commonwealth, but not really. And you know, whereas I think, I mean, from my limited, I'm no kind of expert on conflict in the Middle East or anything, but from what I understand, from what I've been able to kind of gather, and from people, a friend of mine in Brisbane, he was a Jewish guy, his father lived on a kibbutz in Israel, and he really genuinely believed that God gave them that small patch of this planet Earth, and that the Palestinian people who've been there just as long as they have no right to be there because God gave it to them. What are you supposed to do about that? How are you supposed to combat that?
Yeah, well, I guess the way that it is happening is the only way that it can happen, if that's the...
Yeah.
Except maybe some more art instead?
Well, maybe. I mean, I think...
Because I guess that's what you're doing in a way. You're combating that with art.
Absolutely. I'm trying to... combat ignorance, I guess. You know, I mean, I did a solo show last year, and there was an article about it, and you know, one of the kind of closing lines of the articles was sort of something along the lines of, you know, if without having an understanding of the history that Dean is talking about in his work, all of the references will probably just miss you. And I think it was meant as a criticism, but I loved it, and I thought, exactly, that's the fucking problem. It is a problem that Australian people could go to an exhibition, looking at the things I was looking at, dealing with things I was dealing with, and not understand where I was coming from, because it was clear as day. And to have, you know, I was looking at Bonner, right? Specifically the suburb of Bonner, and the kind of the ironic idiocy of naming a suburb after, you know, an Aboriginal person, which is like all well and good on the surface, but you know, we look at this newly built suburb on a newly built city on what is traditionally Indigenous land, so you take something away, but then go, oh, but it's okay because we'll just name this one suburb after one of your guys. You'll like that, guys, right? Like, that'll make you feel a bit better, won't it? And to have no kind of consideration then about the suburb itself, which is just another quickly built capitalist kind of bang 'em up, medium density housing sort of place, a Woolies and a public primary school, you know. You know, that's like totally outrageous, you know. But the gesture was meant in this kind of spirit of reconciliation, you know. But I mean, that's crazy, right? Give the suburb back, give the land back, if that's really what you're trying to do. But they're not. They're trying to make gestures, but the gestures are worse.
Last week, I visited a community near Jabiru called Gunbulanya.
Mm-hmm.
And
cool. That would have been nice.
Yeah. It was a similar situation. I don't know the legal or actual politics around it, but it was a situation where there was housing provided for people to live on their area country. And their land and their country. It made me wonder about everywhere that can never be given back because it's too commercially important.
Mm. Yeah, I think about that a lot here in Sydney.
Yeah.
I think about that a lot. It's difficult.
How do you make work out of all of this?
Well, I kind of hone in on particular narratives that I'm dealing with.
Mm.
Like, for example, this one currently that I'm working on is this Ned Kelly story. And I, extract perhaps iconography that I can rework. I say this, I don't think about it like this, but this is what's happened.
Yeah.
You know, they're kind of... I started making some images and I was chopping wood and just because I needed it for the fire, and one of the bits of wood that came off was like the bark came off this red gum and it was, comparable to the Ned Kelly helmet. And I was like, oh, maybe I'll put that on and take a photo, and then not really thinking too much about it. Then I was like, oh, okay. And then anyway, one thing led to another. I'm like, aha, that's the image. And most of the work that I kind of have done ever, dance included, it springs from one image. I kind of, something comes into the head and then I sort of follow that through, and then that will open up doors into other kind of images and other things. So I'm trying to add another layer of using like scout hall aesthetic and the kind of, and some of the iconography and language of the scouts as this sort of I like the comparison between scouting and initiation, and it's sort of this place where you'd go to learn a lot of the things that young men might go and learn if they were on country being initiated. And I kind of like that, again, there's this like strange parallel there, and and it's all about like being outdoors and camping and fishing and lighting fires and becoming a man.
Which is really just getting skills.
Yeah. Yeah. And in a community way, Scouts is like a really community oriented organization and Christian. It's like highly ritualized.
Yeah.
And I kind of love all those things about them. So I'm trying to then use that as a kind of scaffold to then build into the scaffold the kind of the confluence of a Ned Kelly narrative with our own warriors. Yeah.
Mm.
Replacing the Ned Kellys with their own warriors. I'll show you an image.
Yeah, show me.
You internet peeps can't see it, but you'll just have to come and...
see the show.
You'll have to come to my show, yeah. Got a few weeks. And so it's sort of, that's kind of how it goes in the head, basically. I will start to sort of pick apart some of the things that I like. Getting there. Pull out some of the images that I like. Figure out ways how to best... we're in here somewhere, motherfucker. Figure out ways to best represent that. Where is that, the one I'm looking at? Oh, yeah.
Do you want to describe it?
I was wondering about that. It's really. You. Yeah, it's me. But it's not. I mean, I'm not the subject.
Ah, I see. Yes. Well, your face is covered, so.
Yeah.
And the black and white tone of the photograph leaves it ambiguous as to your skin tone.
Yeah, it does, and I mean, and also to time, it dislocates it from a time, but whilst also though suggesting some sort of nostalgic other time period that's not our own.
Mm.
I'm wearing the bit of wood as the Ned Kelly mask and replaced where the eye holes would was for Dear Edward is ochre, ochre rectangle, which kind of, you know, it's, I mean, would you say it's fairly recognizable as a Ned Kelly helmet?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Like next to Nolan, really.
Yeah, well, that's right. And I mean, that's the other layer, the kind of the art historical layer of, I mean, I'm a huge Nolan fan. And I mean, the other kind of facet of my work or what I try and do or remind myself of is the legacy of Australian visual art informing Australian identity.
Yes.
And
well, even just having a war artist.
Yeah.
It feeds that back.
Yeah. And so I think I try and, you know, I try and connect myself into those visual tropes.
What are you holding?
I'm holding just a bit of wood. It's actually the bit of wood that I use to crush the ochre.
Yep.
To make the, like, to turn it into dust so I could make it then into a paint.
And is that the same ochre that's painted on your chest?
Yeah, that's right. And it comes from home.
So ochre can be any colour?
Yeah, ochre's dry pigment, natural pigment. Yeah, yeah, for sure. But that's a white ochre.
Right. And just exposing some of my own ignorance, I had the vision that ochre was always that orange.
No.
And that clay was the, like, the grey.
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, ochre isn't like a type of rock.
Okay.
It's a word used for a natural pigment.
Yeah.
Yeah. And depending on where you are, the rock might change, the actual rock itself. But I mean, it's usually like a dry, brittle rock that can be, you know, mortar and pestled into a fine powder.
Mm.
And I bet that's different too. I mean, it's different for...
For everywhere.
Yeah, for everywhere. Because everybody's, you know, everybody's region's different. And you know, it's sort of... It's not as simple as just like picking it up out of the ground and putting it on. So like Matilda House, whom adopted me as a kid, whom is a Ngunnawal elder, she was the woman who gave the acknowledgement of country, welcome to country for the opening of New Parliament House. She comes over and she collects this ochre from our house. So, I mean, you've been to my house, you know, like, you know, right where you pull in the cars is that huge big rock face.
Yeah.
So that's an ochre pit.
Oh, wow.
And then over at the quarry, that clay ochre. So that's that.
Wow.
That white stuff is that clay, dry. I've got something I'll show you.
Yeah, right. And then does she, you have conversation with her for it to become something that you can crush up and use?
Yeah, but it's kind of not like I sit there and say, dear auntie, may I use this?
Yeah.
You know, we collect it together. We just hang out, basically. I mean, this was only like a couple of months ago. She was collecting it as for herself for like some of her own stuff. And, you know, it's just like simple as, oh, yeah, of course you can fucking use it. What are you talking about? You know, like it's not a kind of... If I wanted to use, say, an ochre from like far north Queensland, it would be more formal.
Because that's not...
Because it's not my country. It's not... I haven't been adopted up there. I don't belong there. I don't know anybody.
Yeah.
You know, I'd contact somebody, an elder or somebody whom, you know, you'd want to know someone who knows someone sort of thing, and then you would do it formally. This is what I'm trying to do. Can I have some of your ochre? Do you give me permission to use it? I mean, it's still the same sort of process. It's just like when someone's known you since you were second old, it's different, you know.
And can I do that?
You would have to get permission.
Yeah.
Yeah, to use it kind of respectfully. I mean, people do and don't. And this is like one of the kind of main issues and biggest kind of like things to be dealt with kind of contemporary Indigenous art and non-Indigenous people using
maybe I should context
traditional
by saying,
materials.
As far as I'm aware, I only have Anglo-Australian heritage.
Yeah.
And that's why, I mean, that's what I meant for everybody listening.
But if you wanted to, like, say, for example, you know, you're at your house or, I don't know, I mean, you were going to make a show and you wanted to include natural material.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, I mean, it would be, like, appropriate. If you're going to take a lot of it, say you're going to dig a big hole and, like, dump a ton of earth from where you live in Darwin and take it down to Melbourne, and perform at a dance house or whatever, you know, it'd be appropriate, it would be inappropriate not to ask, because that, that ton of earth is like a ton of people, you know. It's like, because there's no separation, you know. Country is not, it's you. And so the kind of, to remove that, that earth in the physical material is to remove like parts of those people who it belongs to. Larrakia or whatever, I guess it is.
Yeah, where I grew up, it was Larrakia. Even at Anzac Day ceremonies, there are always Larrakia people.
Yeah, like, yeah. So that's sort of why, like, it's kind of, I mean, lots of people obviously do.
Yeah.
It just takes stuff, not really thinking about that it might belong to somebody.
Yes.
And that it's not even about belonging, but it's like, you know, it's like skin cells, you know. Like a finger, you wouldn't just take someone's finger, you know.
Without asking.
Without asking permission, you know.
When did this, how, I'm interested in just a little bit of context on your journey from like being a white kid in Canberra, just going to school and then
I think, to this point now. It's, I've never been a white kid. That's the kind of thing, like it was just, the I mean, I grew up still when like it was, you were still a bit embarrassed. You know, and it was like we didn't know really anything about the family and the family history. I mean, we knew, my dad knew enough, but he had a traumatic childhood, right? And so he didn't want to ever talk about his dad. And, you know, we always knew internally as a family unit, like, this is the story. This is kind of where you come from. But because of culture, and even my dad growing up, especially more so for my dad, you just didn't want to be Indigenous. And it's only in the last sort of, I don't know, 20 years, I guess, where people are kind of becoming more and more comfortable with it. And I guess for me, it was about no longer, well, it was about making family connections. So we were disconnected from our family. There were four brothers and two sisters, all who were abandoned by their father, my great-grandfather, raised by a white family. They all then displaced each other and, like, stopped talking to each other. The war happened, so all the brothers went off to the war. One of them died. Two of them came back and just didn't want to know each other. Painful memories, you know, both PTSD kind of cases. And then my grandfather ended up committing suicide after coming back from the war. And so that kind of then stops any kind of direct information or access that I have.
Yeah.
And then, you know, years later, the kind of the family gets back together through the internet, you know, the wonders of the internet. And so that, like, I just had this family reunion on Wednesday where, you know, there's three sets of siblings whom are all cousins, my father and his brother, and then two other sets of their cousins whom all grew up with the same story, the same not knowing but knowing, and but then not really wanting to kind of acknowledge that part of the story because it's better not to be. Yeah. It's better to be a white person when they grow up. And then, yeah, so but anyway, now everyone gets together and it's sort of like okay to talk about it. And for me personally, I felt that, like, you know, it felt uncomfortable or disrespectful to continue to sort of be like, you know, whatever, like, yeah, Indigenous, whatever. Like, my grandfather's an Aboriginal dude. Like, you know, I'd say that as a kid, but never apply that to myself, you know?
Yeah.
You know, because people would say, like, well, what's that? Like, where are you from, sort of thing? And I always thought that was a weird question. Nobody else seemed to get asked that.
It is, like, a weird question.
But people ask it all the time. I mean, people ask me, like, this guy I know, and, like, asked me not that long ago, he said, his words were, "What Nasho are you?"
And is that, like, softer? Is it softer to get asked like that?
What Nasho am I? And he's an Indigenous
like
dude.
Like a Nashi pear.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, that was super weird. But, you know, and as a kid, all the way through high school even, you know, I'd say, oh, well, like, yeah, well, my grandfather's, like, Indigenous. But, like, and then my other side, they're Dutch, Danish, sorry, and but that's it. I don't really know, like, whatever, like, I don't really know what that makes me, sort of thing. But anyway, cut to the future where I kind of get a bit older and realize that it started to feel weird to kind of not make that connection and feel weird to not realize that that is my life and is my lineage and to then it felt kind of disrespectful to kind of continue to not accept it, basically, or like not include me into that. Yeah. And now I guess through making visual art, so much of it has been about catching up a little bit and like filling in that kind of lifetime of denial, you know, and a lifetime of sort of not having any kind of, you know, just feeling like you're floating around sort of thing. Mm. And to kind of then, yeah, like ground myself and connect myself back into my own family, in my own history. And not for it to be this kind of, because it's a weird thing. Like
it's a totally weird thing because it feels somehow, and that just may be simplifying it.
Mm.
It feels opposite to my experience, mm. where, as far as I know and have been told,
mm.
maybe German, maybe Irish, maybe Scottish, mm. maybe English, mm. but like white skin, that mm, part of the world. Mm, mm. But grew up in Darwin, mm. where there's a huge remaining population. I think remaining is mm. the right word because mm. they somehow lasted. Mm. Of Indigenous people, so was around and exposed to culture and language and slang
mm, mm.
in a way where I felt like that was just as much a part of my Australia
mm, mm.
as was my Filipino friends I breakdanced mm, with, as mm. was my Chinese friends. That it's all, yeah, it's almost opposite, where I felt like I had constant exposure mm, to and interaction mm, with mm. without ever thinking I was.
Mm,
and yours mm. is like, well, there's this history that says mm, that I am, mm, but I was not surrounded by or mm, exposed to.
Mm.
And then what does that mean to then start exposing yourself?
Mm. Well, and I mean, it's sort of, as a kid, like it wasn't like it was a whitewash, you know, I mean, Auntie Matilda or whatever, she was around all the time,
yeah.
you know, and her family, and they were just always family.
Yeah.
I knew that they weren't blood family, but they were just considered family. And I mean, as a kid, I used to have, there was another elder called Uncle Eugene Vincent. I used to have didgeridoo lessons with him as a kid and cool. that kind of stuff. So it wasn't like, I mean, because it does happen to some people where, you know, they live most of their life, they turn into adults, and then, you know, they want to kind of make that connection and it happens yeah. for them, and that's sort of, they start from scratch. It's just that I never thought anything about it. So like, I didn't think that it was weird or different or yeah. that it meant something. Like yeah. as far as I was concerned, I was just going to dig lessons with Eugene. Like yeah. I never thought about it. I never thought about it. And like, even, you know, he used to sit outside Woolies in Dixon busking. And I'd just say, hey, you know, Uncle Eugene, and just sit down, hang out while Mum and Dad would shop. And you'd sort of get weird looks. But it never felt weird, and it just kind of wasn't weird. And I guess it's also because, you know, you live a life. I mean, it's obviously complicated by dance, right, and the industry. Because, you know... There's ways, or I don't know how to best, I don't really know how to articulate what I'm trying to say.
Maybe there within dance, there's like something that is representing and mm. recognizable, and mm. then there is what you're saying, which is just people living their lives and doing their thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And that when people want to make a gesture,
mm.
they need to use the representational
mm.
and when people just want to do the thing mm. Mm. then they live their lives, like
yeah.
you say.
Yeah, yeah. I think that definitely that kind of makes a little bit of sense. Yeah, like it was just my life. I didn't ever really think much about it. I didn't feel like I needed to signpost it to the world.
I wonder if this nuanced experience is so common that actually the whitewash narrative is not true for anybody.
It's not. And I mean, that's like the sort of work that I just had that opened just on Friday is exactly about that, and exactly how we've never been a white country ever. We never have been. We never will be. And I think that nobody in their heart of hearts truly believes it. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that because I would say there is probably a lot of people. I mean, I think they're even calling themselves like the National Front or whatever that group is. I'm pretty opposed to Islamic people, but you know, I think like, I mean, Cronulla riots is sort of like an archetypal example where that narrative is deep in the brains, and you know, we grew here, you flew here, sort of as a slogan is so unbelievable. You know,
yeah, mainly because it's not factual.
Exactly, and the ignorance involved to say that, and the kind of the
short-sightedness.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks, and the kind of idea that like they're, you know, these presumably predominantly white Australians, whatever that even means, could have only have been here for a maximum of 200 years. You know,
complete maximum.
Exactly, and so this sort of idea that they have kind of more ownership. And I mean, it's like, you know, kind of, it's like a relationship that you know is ending and you hold on to it even tighter because you know that it's ending. And so I think like, and so you make all this fuss and drama because you actually secretly know that the connection is failing. And I think in this case, it's the knowing that the connection is still new. And we look to Europe, we look to all these other cultures whom, you know, it's like we sort of like hundreds of years old. I'm like, wow, like, you know, this building was here in 1600. And then again, the ignorance of not acknowledge our own indigenous culture, saying, well, they're an unbroken culture for 80,000 years. Some people think longer, you know. So I think there's this sort of mass amnesia.
Yeah.
That hopefully myself in my art over a lifetime might be able to help be part of the solution, hopefully. I'll be pretty pleased if I can contribute to that over a lifetime of working, can contribute to a better idea of what it really means to be an Australian in the 21st century.
I think when you know yourself and then all the signs are telling you that what you know is just an ideal that you were sold. A non-ideal ideal.
Yeah, yeah.
Then there is so much fear because the question is, well, then what am I?
Yeah, for sure.
And I know what that's like. I had this discussion with some people who are, say, Filipino Australian or Indian Australian. And they have somehow a second culture to be when they are not the white side of the Cronulla riots.
Yeah.
And then I feel like some of what I keep coming up to deal with the Blokes Project is, yes, we can let go of this false narrative that there ever was white Australia. But we can't leave these people with nothing because that's when they will scream and push back and fight harder.
No.
And it's like, it's not an acknowledgement of respect or consideration for them. So what can it be?
Well, I mean, I think like I would never want to take away Anglo-Australians' connection to this country, you know, because that's totally counter to what I'm trying to do. All I'm trying to do is to bring up all the collective narratives onto a level playing field, the web, to understand it, coming back to that web kind of idea, a constellation where they're all interconnected. One doesn't have, in a three-dimensional space, like a floating space, there's no hierarchy, there's no, you know, preferred thing. They're all connected, one to each other, all complex in relation to each other, but none more prominent than the other. Just a simple kind of, and in my mind it is simple, it's a simplified version of there are many historical truths that can all coexist. And it's about, for me, I like to try, at least in my work, is to present multiple historical truths at the same time, so also to point out the kind of the problems of how those narratives have been dealt with, but also to kind of highlight that they both exist, they coexist.
What's the best way to do that?
Oh, I don't know.
Because it's not dance. Or you might be doing dance.
Well, I mean, there's no best because, you know.
I guess I mean effective. Like, what is the way to offer somebody another truth to hold alongside the one that they have so that they will take it from you?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't want answers. What I want is, like, what have you found? What have you discovered in trying to do this?
I've discovered that people actually are aware individually, or are willing to become aware, yeah, that it's okay to talk about conflicting narratives, and it's okay to accept them on a kind of in a web like flux, that it's not fixed. Historical narratives aren't fixed, and that it's sort of important to get as much information from as many angles as possible, so that whatever construct you choose to adhere to or create is the most informed one possible. Mm-hmm. Because you have that choice. You can either kind of accept one that's given to you, which is fine, as long, you know, everybody has their agency to do that, or you work a little bit harder maybe, and then sort of figure out for yourself what you think the truth of a situation might be, and the truth of a nation, you know, might be. And to kind of not blindly refuse one inconvenient truth over another. And I mean, again, this work that I just showed was censored, or attempted. There was an attempted censorship of the work. Initially, it was banned from this exhibition because it supposedly presented an inconvenient truth. And then that ban was then kind of moved to just a censorship, so that the kind of inconvenient truth was just less visible. And then reason finally, through negotiation, prevailed. And the parties realized that censoring a work, trying to erase or not acknowledge an inconvenient truth of the past, is futile, and that by censoring it would actually make it far more visible. You know, yeah, I mean, you put a black bar across somebody's tits on an image, you look at it and you know there's tits under there, you can just fill in the blanks, you don't need to see them, and so you think more about them. And it's the same with the work, you know. I was sort of happy for them to censor it in a way, because it would have made people ask harder and look harder. Why would that be like that? What is trying to be censored here? Anyway, as it was, it didn't matter.
So, looking at time,
mm-hmm, that's a big one to tackle.
what's your biggest hope?
Oh. Die happy.
Yeah. Yep. Great. Me too.
Yeah, I mean, I try not to close down anything like that. I don't know. Just to, like, kick about and keep doing what I'm doing. I don't know. It's tough. What is my biggest hope?
Just for all this effort.
Well, I mean, there's certainly the, I guess it's sort of egoic part of me that really genuinely feels that I'm able, or will be able, to make a contribution to the cultural landscape and thus the historical landscape. And I do believe that if I work hard enough and continue to push and continue to kind of, you know, work as hard as I've enjoyed working over the past few years, that in time, you know, you will be able to impact some kind of rethinking. I mean, I think it takes time. It may not necessarily even be within our lifetime, our lifespan, but, you know, I think, like I said before, I think a lot about the role of painting especially, but that's just a more kind of global trend of art in the kind of early 20th century, late 19th century, and the role that image making played in helping a newly formed country figure out its own identity. And so if I can kind of contribute to that process for the Australians of the future, the next generation, or the next five generations, then, you know, that I'll be pretty satisfied with that. But, you know,
maybe we'll be beyond nations by then.
Well, I think that's sort of, I mean, that's the other kind of thing, like, how necessary is it? And you're right. I mean, I think the future of the planet is outside of nationhood. I don't think that it will be relevant in maybe 200, 300, 400 years' time.
Yeah.
I don't think it will be.
Yeah.
But at the moment, you know, tribal and genetic connection to places all over the world is strong, and tradition is still strong, and people's want to connect. I mean, I think the kind of, you know, we somehow inherently know that we are of this earth and we are connected to it in ways that can't really be expressed, yeah. You know. And I think that perhaps, I mean, I think about that if, like, can we really survive on another planet? I'm not sure.
No, I was listening to, I forget which one, but I'll link to it, the biggest psychological challenge for people going to Mars is that they'll reach a point where they can't see the Earth, and that's the first time that will have ever happened for any human.
Mm. Yeah, that's wild, you know. And I mean, I think that there'll be perhaps a trend. I mean, also, people are pretty adaptable, so I imagine there's this transition where the first people that go there will be really desperately unhappy, but, you know, after a couple of generations, those new humans will be Martians.
Yeah.
They won't belong to Earth. But then, then there's, like,
an Earth-Mars, you
know,
war.
Well, not even that, but, like, you know, however many hundreds of thousands of years of human genetic DNA, you know, and God knows what the next, whatever's after Homo sapiens, whatever's next. And I mean, it can't be far away either. You know, I think that this sort of, I mean, and whether or not it's aided through technology, this sort of genetic uplifting, upsizing, who knows? But probably these people won't actually be Homo sapiens either. So maybe they won't have this kind of, and I mean, I guess I talk about it in the sense of, like, you know, when I go to war in my country, you know, I was there just recently for a while, and I imagine that, like, you know, it's a similar experience for any Indigenous person. It's hard to describe the feeling of knowing that your blood, your true, like, genetic blood has been in that place for countless generations, you know, and you feel that somehow. It's sort of, it's hard. It's a hard one to describe to people.
Yeah,
it's a deep thing, a deep feeling. Yeah, and I mean, maybe it's perhaps for people whom are the thousands, probably, of Indigenous people whom are forced, have been dislocated, not by choice, but by a kind of war and just whatever. You know, perhaps those people are the ones that are looking for it harder, and the people whom grow up on country fully connected to that history, you know, it might not be such a big deal for them, but I don't know. I don't think so, though.
Yeah, I've thought about it a lot. I've thought about, well, everyone must have an indigenous, like a connection to some land somewhere at some point in their history.
And I mean, I think this, like, you know, that's where the idea of out of Africa has come from, which I think they're rethinking.
Yeah.
I don't think they are convinced. And I think certainly an article I read certainly was suggesting that it was not necessarily singularly out of Africa, but perhaps also could have sprung from what has become an Australian continent and other places.
I've also heard, what has become known as the Pacific.
Yeah, yeah.
The islands around there.
Let's
just say plural. Let's just all of them. All the time, just meeting each other.
Well, I think it's only logic that tells us that it has to have come from, because, like,
single narrative logic.
Yeah, because, you know, you have a mother and a father, and then they have a mother and a father. Each of them, each has one, and we know that. You know, we know that. I mean, it's again already becoming a grey area in the 21st century with technology. You don't necessarily need one of each, but You used to, certainly. And so, yeah, again, the singular unidirectional narrative sends our brain back, and logic will then tells us, well, at some point it has to have started from somewhere.
Singularity.
From a man and a woman, Adam and Eve.
Yeah.
That's logical. Mm. But I think then also the world, the natural world, can be pretty illogical, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, oh, God, like, I think there's probably millions of dollars being spent on trying to answer that question. And whether or not it's money well spent, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm, you know, of course you're curious. Yeah, where did we come from? Like, all the way back. Like, that's pretty interesting. But I don't know, like...
I don't know either as well. Because at one point you are disengaging from the animal world.
Yeah, that's right.
And you're saying, okay, at this point we are no longer a part of. We are now other. We are now separate. And that seems to have had its benefits and costs as well.
And I would say in the long run has probably been our downfall, you know, dislocating ourselves from the natural world that we live in is probably what's going to undo us, or has already undone us in the long run.
Mm.
I mean, I love YouTube, but, you know.
You could do without it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I also love sitting next to a campfire.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Have you ever YouTubed campfires? I have.
Yeah. I think I have. Not necessarily campfires, but like
fireplace.
Like fireplace. Yeah.
Is there anything that I haven't asked that you would like to bring up? I don't know, an epiphany that you had, or a thought that hasn't yet become a project that you're still working real hard on? Like, no. My freshest thought that still hasn't become a project is. Mm. Maybe I have a folk dance.
Cool.
And then what is my people that I have that folk dance with? Is it the like cosmopolitan internet connected generation?
How are you defining folk dance?
Exactly. Because I'm trying to release it from aesthetic, but it is a dance that you do with your people, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a people attached to the dance somehow.
Mm.
And
a tradition.
Yeah. But my people doing the rabbit ears are no longer in one place, in one time, because we are constantly interacting across the world, like via plane flights or via internet, seeing each other dance around the world.
Mm.
And so though that's affecting the dance that exists in my body because I imitate, but then also the music that comes to me makes me want to move in different ways. And so I feel an impetus to jig when I hear like a lagophone for some reason or a fiddle, but at the same time, I really feel the impetus to twerk, for want of a better word, when the right song comes on. So like, is there in that...
Yeah, I think
and
that's...
And I only ask that question because I am existing... If I exist within the whitewash narrative of Australia, I have no folk dance.
Mm.
Except for a British dance that I don't want and I don't associate with. So, but it's so raw and so fresh, I don't know anything about it. I just wondered if you had things like that.
No, I mean, that sounds interesting. I think the language you use is interesting, that you don't want it. You know it's there, but you don't want it, which is like implies some kind of... And I think, again, it's like a pretty widespread feeling for people, like of wishing there was some form of like exoticism within oneself that makes you somehow different from of homogenous, you know, middle-class white male.
Yeah. The exoticism, I'm more like trying to find the dance of the lack of exoticism, because I understand that when you are exotic, which is a horrible term, you have a dance.
Yeah.
You have a cultural dress or dance or language.
Yeah.
And when you're not exotic, you don't. But what if I could have a dance without needing to be exotic and without needing to pull from my cultural roots? Yeah.
I mean, I think too... You know, things like YouTube complicate it hugely because, you know...
And even Vines or Snapchat.
I know. I love the Vines. They blow my mind. I think like anthropologists must love them,
yeah.
You know, because it is this like strangely mediated / unmediated, like they're edited, but they're not. It's so amazing. They blow my mind. I love them. I mean, that's something I think about those a lot, and how I'm going to use them, because they're this amazing resource. But then what, like, again, what fascinates me about the vines is the, when you, by the time they get to my eyes, they've already been through so many processes and so many people's like choices, you know, that the ones I get to see are usually the same ones from the same people. And then I think, who's making these videos? Who's collecting the vines and cutting out the ones that they don't like, and then only distributing to me the ones that they think I'll like, you know? And the way the kind of vine video, it has a form, a very, very kind of uniform form of, you know, from 10 to 15 minutes. Then lately now there's a little bit of basketball before the babes start. That's newish.
You know, you're at the end when there's
That's sort of new. It wasn't like that, you know, that crept in. The way the thumbnails are always a babe, you know.
Yeah, the comments on the side, so in case you miss it.
Yeah. And how, like, so already from that we know that they're, like, being made by straight men for straight men, or lesbians, I guess. But... you know, all of that is like, I just, yeah, they really blow my mind. I mean, whether or not I'm going to make work about them, maybe at some point. I think they're a pretty rich resource.
Yeah. Well, then the thing that becomes fascinating to me is that I am not American. I am not British. But these are part of my culture, my living culture.
For sure.
And that is where I think I need to start having this folk dance investigation. Which is, there is no way that the folk dance of my time can be, of like my subculture or self-identity or whatever that is restricted to a place.
No, definitely not. And if it is, it's a virtual place.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I mean, that's another, I guess, side project that I'm always sort of working on is cultural colonization and, you know, how... here in Australia, you know, particularly, I guess, through the 80s and 90s, you know, we had a kind of strong American influence. And, you know, where was I? I was in Brisbane and, you know, baseball fields. And, you know, even I used to play baseball as a kid. Wow. It's like so quintessentially American. And even basketball, you know, the basketball has been on the Olympics, really celebrated. Patty Mills, like, what a champ, gun player. But then I look at basketball, it's a cultural American icon. American cultural icon. And so
it's a colonization of the body the same way that ballet is from the French.
That's been more stretched through time,
right?
And and was, you know, the transmission of ballet was happening through you know, physical colonization as well, you know. Not the way that, like, American culture has been adopted willingly by, and I'm sure it is the same in other countries, but you see it here a lot. Well, obviously, because this is where I spend most of my time, I see it a lot, but, you know, I find that pretty fascinating. That's definitely stuff that I like to, that I will be working on in the future. For sure. I think it's really, telling of our own kind of cultural void that we're hoping to fill.
When I did the residency at the National Film and Sound Archive, it started becoming really clear when we started switching from the BBC towards American cinema.
Right.
And it's also become apparent to me that neither of those things are ever classed as foreign film.
Oh God, I think about that all the time. It's like best foreign film, any film that's not American or English, you know? It doesn't make any sense.
No.
They just need to get rid of that label, because foreign to what? Or be clearer about it. You know, best non-American or English film. It's crazy. And these are the sorts of things that I'm hoping to dissolve through work. You know, hoping to, you know, because it's like, it's this sort of simple thing, you know, exactly. You have that thought and you go, hang on, best foreign film. What? Foreign to what? Foreign to who? You know, to the Americans. So now we realize that they're dictating the terms. And that's not the world that anybody wants to live in anymore. We know better than that, surely. I do believe that we do know better than that. And I just think it's taking us time to act out that kind of knowing because it's still so new. We're only just figuring it out. And I think that, you know, in time, little things like that, these kind of, hegemonic powers are going to dissolve into a more kind of fluid and sort of malleable and less rigid sort of structure, you know. And I think, you know, like, this is going to be a long bow to draw or whatever, but, you know, as our technological understanding, right, let's look at the Eiffel Tower. It's like, it's rigid, it's triangles, it's steel, it's strong, it's straight, it's vertical, slight curves, but, you know, it's a vertical structure reinforcing a vertical way of thinking, a hierarchy. Whereas now technology, you know, is more fluid. Nanotechnology allows for things that we once thought could only ever be hard and firm to be flexible. Mm. And I think that, like our phones, for example, it's just one bad example where, you know, there already are mobile phones where you can bend them, move them. They're not fixed. They're formless in that sense, you know. And I think that formlessness is reflecting or will reflect also the way that we approach culture or accept culture or accept truths of the past to no longer necessarily be that way.
Yeah, I wonder if there used to be this idea that like the collapsing interface would mean that we would end up with one device that would do everything for us, one technological device. Mm. But it seems like what's happened instead because of our current technological restrictions around making hard things soft and fragile things robust is that we have many, many devices for different parts of our lives, but they all let us access the same data bank of information of our own and shared.
Mm.
And so what that might be training us towards is pluralism.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
That's nice.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
A nice accident.
Well, it depends on which parts of us become pluralized. I mean, you already see it in Facebook as the perfect example of people already existing in you know, multiplicity, you know, where you have your real, I'm doing the fingers again, everybody, real.
IRL, in real life.
IRL, yeah. Yeah, you've got the IRL and everything else, yeah. You know, and they don't necessarily have to have anything to do with each other.
Do you remember when you used to not be on the internet with your real name?
Yeah. Yeah, and even now, I mean, you know, my Instagram thing is not quite my real name, but it is, but it isn't. You know, it's a signifier of it. It isn't my real name, but for all intents and purposes, it is. You know.
Thanks, Dean.
No worries. Thank you, Matt. Thanks, everybody. Keep it real.